Welcome to Accept Your Gifts, the 22-minute podcast for inspiring your most creative life. My name is Tracy Crow. I'm an author, writing coach, and Marine Corps veteran. I'm looking forward to co-creating today's show with you. So if you're ready, are you ready? I'm ready. So if you're ready to live a more creative, more magical life, let's get started. Thank you for returning to part two with my special guest, Elizabeth Torres Evans, Liz to all of us who know and dearly love her. Now, if you recall from part one in episode 29, Liz shared candidly about how post-traumatic stress has affected her marriage with Chester, a combat Marine who served in Vietnam. Liz revealed that thanks to her devotion to journaling, she suddenly discovered that their greatest challenges happen during the same time every year, every April. For a little more than a year now, Liz has been working on a memoir about surviving post-traumatic stress. Today, she'll read an excerpt for us. And after her reading, Liz provides a few more insights about the very turning point for her special Marine Chester and for both of them. And here we go.
The title of my book is Trains Coming, Our Struggle with PTSD. This is Chapter 8, April. My journal entry dated 4/22/08. We had a serious breakthrough on Saturday. It had been a particularly bad blow-up the evening before over the TV. The front satellite box went out, and I was talking to a tech because Chester wanted it fixed. When I walked into the bedroom with a phone, I switched the channel and he blew up at me later when I got off the phone. When I tried to defend myself, he got more upset. When I read that journal entry now, I'm taken aback by the even tone I used to describe that night. Yes, it was written after the fact, but it had none of the emotion, none of the sounds, the fears, nor the panic I had felt the night he went off. I'd become pretty good at denial. His episodic tirades, though farther and fewer between by this point, our almost 10-year marriage mark, were decidedly more debilitating. They also were arguably more devastating for that fact alone. I thought after all the years of counseling and adapting our life to his needs, his anger would abate. It's a tough takeaway when you come to the conclusion that what you've done, what you've tried to do, what you hope to do, could be unmade in a single heated exchange of words. We had been at our new home at Evans Ridge for almost 3 years by the time the incident in April happened. Our ranch-style modest home was situated on 3 acres of woods and wildlife on a secondary road lined with pine, oak, and ash trees. Those trees had given me a new appreciation for the changing seasons in North Carolina. I loved driving down that road, crossing the bridge, and seeing my house set away from the road with the woods as a backdrop. I had a half-hour commute from my office in Raleigh to Evans Ridge, and on that particular night in April, it was already dark when I got home. I was tired, ready to decompress with a glass of wine while I put dinner together for us. I could see through the dining room window when I pulled into the driveway that the TV was on. After he greeted me and asked me how my day was, he then said, "Something's wrong with the TV. When you get settled, I need to see if you can figure it out." I know my look must have reflected the exasperation I felt. "Really? I've been at work all day and still need to make dinner, and you need me to get on the phone with DirecTV? Spend whatever little time I have left of the evening fixing the TV so you can watch recorded CSI or Jerry Springer episodes?" I hadn't said the words, but I didn't need to. My looks were infamous. That was strike one, the look. I put down my bag that had work in it, in case I got ambitious and wanted to go over medical records closer to midnight. As a personal injury paralegal, I had upwards of 115 files with clients in various stages of treatment. One of my jobs at this firm was to draft a demand package for the attorney to review and submit to the insurance company. Medical records, medical insurance, and accident report reviews and dissemination was the easy part. To talking with medical providers, insurance representatives, and clients took up 85% of my day. It was draining, yes. Home was a refuge, until it wasn't. DirecTV was a necessary evil. I hated when the TV boxes acted up or the satellite was not working properly, but typically we had been trouble-free for a couple of years. The tech I spoke to was polite, put me through the regimen of unplugging the box, waiting until the system was up and running. When the problem persisted, he had me run diagnostics on the front TV. When that was done, he had me run the same diagnostics on our other TV in the master bedroom, where Chester was watching a program. I had the phone to my ear and was listening to the tech's direction. I had picked up the remote to follow his instructions. He had me change the channel while he ran a check on his end. I did what he was told and turned off the TV to reboot the box. That was strike two, messing with his TV. After ending my conversation with the tech, I went back to report to Chester. He was standing at the foot of the bed waiting for me. "I was watching that show," he said tightly. "You asked me to call them to see what could be done to fix it," I shot back, making his eyebrows raise then lower to a straight line across his forehead at my sharp tone and volume. I have a voice that carries and consciously have to moderate it. Not that night. "What do you want from me?" I continued. I should have stopped then, but I was tired. My feelings hurt and my tolerance frayed. I work all day with people that need something from me. I come home for a little peace and have to deal with this moment, the moment I get home. It couldn't wait. He stood there looking at me. He started to respond, and then he stopped. "Fuck it," he said finally. "I told you I've been home all day, not bothering anyone, and you come home and this shit starts? I've told you before, Liz, I was fine alone. I could manage my life alone. I told my exes, if you can't help me in the things I need help with, what do I need you for?" I looked at him, turning slowly and walked down the hall to the front room before I said something I would regret. He was going to begin the comparison between his life with his exes and his new life with me. I knew if I responded, it was really going to get ugly. How could he compare our life together with his life before? I stood in front of the TV and turned it off. "They're sending someone down here to fix the front connection. You can only watch in the back." I tossed the remote on the chair in his direction. That was strike three. "What the fuck? What do you think you're doing?" he shouted, starting to come toward me. I didn't flinch, and I didn't break eye contact. I had gone cold. "I'm not getting locked up," he said as he stopped, fist clenched on his thighs, his voice thick with emotion. He stared at me hard, his mouth open, and all I envisioned was the end of my life with him when he said, "This is not working, Liz. I've done everything I can. You can't be mean to me. I told you in the beginning. I told you this wouldn't work. This is too fucking hard. I was alone in one room with no cares. I don't need this. I don't need any of this." He looked back at me, his arm gesturing the contents of the living room. Me included. I knew he had meant me included in the remark. What else could he have meant? I felt physically ill. All I had struggled with him over the years welled up inside me, presenting themselves in flash scenes like a slideshow of a cherished vacation. The night he reached for me when the phone woke us up out of our sleep. Day 33 when he was released from observation by the La Jolla VA. The night on the dance floor at the staff club when he told me he knew he was in so much trouble. The night we were married when hours before he had told me he could get on one of those Greyhound buses. The night he drove me around the back roads where he grew up as a boy, stopping the car on the deserted road and turning off all the headlights so I could see how dark the night was and the stars that shone through. The day he loaded the Penske truck with all we had in the world and Megan between us on our perch between us for the next 4 days, leaving California in the rearview mirror and heading to North Carolina. The day he broke our kitchen table in pieces because I'd moved it. The day he stood outside our first apartment in North Carolina when my dad told him, "I like the way you're taking care of my girls." The day the sheriff came to arrest him and I thought I was going to lose him forever. The day we sat on the floor of our new home and he told me, "I have loved you long enough and been with you long enough that your dream has become my dream." Dread crushed me. I walked away from Chester, leaving the room without responding, and retreated to the guest room. I was numb. I went through the motions of getting ready for bed, slipping in and out of the guest room to use our master bathroom. I don't remember hearing him at all that night. All my senses felt like they were enveloped in a cotton ball. I, who cry embarrassingly easy, had no tears, not one. I fell into an exhausted sleep and a couple of hours later woke up startled. Why was I in the guest room? The reveals come in those quiet hours between the moonset and sunup. Until that night, we'd never slept in separate beds. Even during the work week, when I went to bed before him because I got up at 6 in the morning, we slept in the same bed. I couldn't remember a time when he'd gone to bed angry with one another. We had never not tried to talk out any incident that had come up until that night. I felt and heard our cat sister, who typically slept with me on my side of our bed, stretch and yawn as my stirrings had woken her. It touched me that she had joined me in my self-isolation in the guest room. At least the cat still loved me. I realized I couldn't rationalize what had taken place that night. It was not the first time he'd been angry or verbally abusive. It was not the first time I'd triggered his response. I was trying to remember the last time it had been that loud, that mean, and that startling. There had been the blinds and the California trip. There seemed to be another incident. Something happened during a time at the track when he went off at someone during races. I had a vague memory of him telling me about his reaction to a car backfiring, scaring him so bad he took off running. Something about one of the guys teasing him. I don't know why I was trying so hard to recall these instances, perhaps only to reason with myself that they were isolated. They were, but I also felt that if I tried to recall all the times he'd gone off and all the surrounding circumstances, maybe, just maybe, I could deal better with what happened last night. I stood by the window at the foot of the bed, looking out on the front lawn lit low by the early morning light. I recalled something Chester's roommate, Tank, had told my husband when we were dating. I was a resolution person. I was a problem solver. Chester had been my project that first date. I was in the process of fixing my life with God, trying to do the right thing. I had no end game when we first met. I was on a path of recovery and redemption. When we knew we were in love and he was reluctant to take the first step, I campaigned hard for either let's be friends and get our heels in the ceiling and have fun, or let's do this by faith and believe in the love and see where it could take us. When I think of that morning and the unknown that laid ahead, I remember how my father didn't speak to me for 9 months when he found out I was marrying Chester. At that time, I believed that part of his silence was his prejudice. I later found out that in most things, there were many layers from childhood, school, the Navy, and just the times he grew up in that shaped part of my father's trepidation. It took him time to work through it. I also realized he was worried for me and Megan. It was no wonder he told me I couldn't save the world all those years ago. He had reason to be concerned. From his perspective, a mixed-race marriage, a daughter had 2 failed marriages and grandchildren that suffered as a result, a veteran with PTSD who was moving his new family to the South. What wasn't there to worry about? Was I in jeopardy of ending a third marriage? All those statistics about veterans with PTSD and multiple marriages I'd read about and was now a part of, was I about to be another statistic in the VA PTSD Families Stressors.gov file? It stung. The thought of fighting so hard to have a love that could withstand the trials of the past, the struggles of our present, and whatever came down the pike, that we could be another number on a statistics table, really stung. Early in our marriage, in what I recognize as false bravado, I'd told him, "I may be your third wife, but I'm your last." Part of me didn't see what we'd gone through as just PTSD related. It was life. It was marriage. It was a compromise. It was adjustment. It was his PTSD baggage and my self-worth baggage. Or was it? Was it compassion fatigue? Was it pent-up frustration from suppressing my own needs? Or was I really just that mean? After washing up and getting dressed, I grabbed my pen, my glasses, and my journal and went to the kitchen. After making a strong cup of coffee, opening all the windows on my side of the breakfast table, I attempted what had become a favorite practice. Taking in the view of the backyard, watching and listening as the woods woke, trying to manage a long, appreciative look at the simple beauty of our life. I wanted to write about the evening's events and my thoughts, But all I could think of was I really wasn't ready for this all to end. My marriage, my home, my kitchen table next to the window, my life. We need to talk. He startled me badly. I usually hear the bedroom door or him coming down the hall, but he had been quietly standing there by the fireplace. I closed my journal, trying to buy a little time while I collected myself. I got up and poured another cup of coffee. He said nothing while he waited. I sat back down at the breakfast table and looked up at him. His problem with the night before had to do with my unwillingness to help him when I know that he struggles with numbers and instructions because of his dyslexia. I listened, but so wanted to get up and walk away. I'd heard this before. It didn't matter all the other times I was there for him and helped him when he struggled with reading. It was the couple of times I wasn't in the last 10 years that would break our marriage. Of all the conversation that ensued, his next words would never leave me. "Do you have any idea how it makes me feel to ask for help?" he looked at me as he asked, the pain evident on his lined face. "It takes me immediately to first grade when I got into trouble that first day of school, because I went into the girls' bathroom instead of the boys' because I couldn't read." The image of that little boy getting into trouble and having trouble all his life because of an undiagnosed learning disability made my angst seem petty and small. Part of me understood I was never going to be able to be impatient with him or express exasperation concerning his pull on me. Never. When he said, "I don't need this, any of this. I was living in one room when you met me, one TV, one chair, one bed. I don't want to think this hard, Liz. I don't want to hurt like this. It's not worth it. I'd rather be alone." I don't remember my exact words in response. I know I told him it was never my intention to hurt him. I know I told him there were times his needs were more than I can handle at times, that I needed time to tend to my own needs. I remember asking him, "Was that unreasonable?" "It was the way I communicated it to him," he responded without answering the question, as if he's supposed to read my mind. "Something I accused him of doing in the past? How do you know what you're thinking if you don't tell me?" I wanted him to see how his needs at times left nothing for me to draw from for myself, but it felt self-serving. I got up to put my cup in the sink, the dread spreading through my body, petrifying me incrementally. "When you told me you were afraid this would not work, that you would hurt us, remember what I told you?" I asked, looking at him through the opening over the sink as he stood there by the fireplace. I went on after a moment when he didn't respond. "I told you that if I did anything to hurt you, I would leave you. I wouldn't be the one that put you back in that place you were before. But," I paused, unsure whether to say it, the next part, "what the hell? If we were over, we were over. Just be sure this is what you want, to be alone. Please don't say this to threaten me." The look he gave me was classic. Like, really, you're going to threaten me with threatening you? Wrong guy. Before he could say anything, I put my head down, and something had been nagging at me in my sleep, in the hours when I first woke, at the table when I sat with my journal unopened, suddenly presented itself. It occurred to me just now that if I look back over my journal entries since we've been together, that I would find some incident, some argument or blow-up that occurred around this time. Maybe not every year, but almost every year around this time. I remember the silence that grew between us, and the nervousness made me move back to the breakfast table thinking, he must think I'm buying for time before he closes the door on us for good. I had looked over at him waiting. He said quietly, "I left Dee in April. I think I left Jackie in April. I know I checked into the VA for the first time in April." His expression thoughtful, head slightly tilted as he spoke, eyes not seeing me, seeing something, some memory that my words had brought to the surface. I'm notorious for being slow on the uptake. It was no different then, when I didn't get the significance of what he was saying. I was still smarting from the look he'd given me moments before. I remembered feeling the impatience at what might be the inevitable. I had felt it before. I had been here before, at the end of a marriage. In that case, I'd responded, resigned. I'll leave in July, but I'm not leaving in fucking April. Tracy, there are a couple of instances that I can think of that were pivotal with Chester's recovery and ongoing recovery. But I want to say, in addition to the incident that happened in April, it was the year 2011 that was significant. In January of 2011, I had lost my job as a claims paralegal after almost 7 years with that particular firm. 2 weeks after I lost my job, we lost Karen to a blood clot that stopped her heart. Karen was Sam's wife, and Karen and Sam were Chester's lifelong friends, also Marines. Karen had been Dee's matron of honor and Sam, Chester's best man, when they got married. And Sam had been our best man when we got married. We were all devastated. Chester journeyed by car cross country to help Sam and his adult children with the mourning process they were going through and with arrangements. When he returned from that trip, he told me that on the way there, he had grieved his mother's passing. When he had been 14, he had lost her to breast cancer, that he grieved her passing on that trip to Sam and the kids. He also told me that in that month he had been there, he and Sam had talked about the judo, the kids, raising money, and they decided that we needed to do a golf tournament to raise money. Now, my husband has a judo background in the Marine Corps. He's a 10-year All-Marine champion. Judo had been his other job in the Marine Corps. And when he fell and had a C4 injury, he could no longer compete. He fell in the barracks in a bathroom. And it almost paralyzed him. He recovered, tried to compete, couldn't, and then decided to transition into coaching. Got a coach's certificate, did that sporadically, until he got a gig teaching judo at a karate dojo here in Raleigh. The problem was there were kids that could afford to do karate but couldn't afford to pay for judo and maybe couldn't afford to go to competition. So the golf tournament was a means to raise money. And we pulled on an experience we had with a friend, also deceased, who had raised money for cancer. And we pulled on that experience, called a couple of friends, one in particular that came in and helped us with the setup and some of the details. But Chester was the one that devised the business plan. He knew he needed so many people to donate $100 each, and that would cover the golf course. He needed so many people to make donations, and that would cover the trophies and the food. Those were the three major expenses. And in that year, he went out, he contacted all his former golf friends. He contacted friends that were in judo and people he knew. He asked friends, he asked family, and he got the donations he needed to cover the tournament. The couple that we pulled on were the cousin of the friend that we had lost that had put on a fundraising golf tournament before, the Hancocks. They came and spent the weekend of that golf tournament with us and laughed at us beginning to second guess whether or not this was going to go off right. We knew who was coming. We knew we had the tournament, you know, ready. We knew we had our prizes, but we still were second guessing ourselves. And we laugh when we think about when Chester went at dawn 30 to be there in time for any golfers that would show up. And the only person that was there when he arrived was the groundskeeper. And for about an hour, no one showed. But I think it was at the end of that golf tournament when we stood watching everybody leave. It was remote. golf course out in the middle of the country in Lewisburg, and people came from Virginia, people came from South Carolina. These are the friends that we have that support us. And that was 2011. This month we're going to, or next month actually, we're going to have our first spring bash. And in October we'll be holding our ninth El Toro Fall Bash. And it's named El Toro after the Judo Club. And the Judo Club is named after the El Toro Marine Air Base in Tucson, California, where his home dojo was at. And when we counted all the money and we donated to a couple of local dojos, and we donated to the father of a young man who was undergoing chemotherapy for cancer and wanted to go to Legoland, it was the most gratifying thing we'd done. And I know for him, it was one of the most satisfying and gratifying things he'd done. He had the idea along with Sam, but he implemented it. He saw it through and he executed. And for a man who, in my experience, had start and stopped projects all our marriage, this was significant because it put him out there. It put him out there dealing with people that he really didn't want to have to deal with. But he cared about his kids and he cared about giving them something to be able to work with going forward in judo. And for me, I think it was a moment in which he accepted his gifts.
I hope you enjoyed today's co-creative listening experience. Please remember to leave a comment about the single greatest takeaway for you today. You know, that one thing you will remember from this day forward. Was it something funny or provocative? Was it just what you needed to hear? Please share so we can all benefit. And remember to return Tuesdays and Thursdays to Accept Your Gifts, the 22-minute podcast for inspiring your most creative life.